Mr. Goyer, perhaps we could spend a bit of your time today on sort of a summing up of the operations of the international division between 72 and 73 when you were there as a executive staff assistant.
Okay, the international automotive operations can really be thought of as, I guess, three subunits, although it wasn't divided up organizationally in such a fashion. But the major three units, as I saw them, were Southeast Asia, which took in everything from New Zealand north up to Japan, and eventually China when Mr. Nixon decided to play ping pong with the Chinese or whatever it was he did. Mm-hmm. So that was one segment of it. The second segment was the South American segment, and that literally included all of the countries in South America, all the major ones where we either had operations or to which we exported what we called a KD kits, knocked down kits. In some of those countries, we would have a major dealer who would assemble those kits and be our wholesaler to other dealers. But that's the second one, the South American thing. The third, and by far, in the management's, particularly Mr. Ford's viewpoint, most important one was Europe. Mm-hmm. Canada, of course, was part of the U.S. We treated Canada as part of the U.S. North American, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Europe was by far the most important, the oldest, I guess, or at least the oldest in terms of any big volume business. And it, a little bit, had a subunit within it, and that was the tractor operations in Europe, which were rather important, but did not originally, and I don't know how they do it now or how they did it with Ford Europe, I can't quite remember. But at one time, the tractor operations reported to the DPO, Diversified Products man, not to the international man. Matter of fact, when Bob Hampson had DPO, he had tractors right. in Europe. Mm-hmm. So he had those three. It was by his behavior and attitude and what he said and the way he operated, it was pretty much pretty obvious to most of us that Mr. Ford loved Europe. Mm-hmm. At one time, one rather high-placed executive said that he believed that if Mr. Ford could figure out a way to still remain chairman of the board of the parent company and also run Ford of Europe as an operating officer, he'd like to do it that way. But Mr. Ford was very very fond of Europe. And as a result of that, at least when Mr. Iacocca was chief operating officer, which obviously by title included Europe as everything else sure. as far as operating, yeah. Mr. Iacocca, while he went to Europe, and attended, you know, call regular meetings and so forth, many of which, when I was working for him, I went with him on, and did some other staff people. It was obvious that was Mr. Henry Ford's show, and Lee did not get into the meat grinding, hard decision, you know, the way he operated in the U.S. And it was rather clear, he told me, you know, he said, Mr. Ford likes Europe. He likes around Europe, and I don't think he needs or wants a lot of help with it, and that's fine. You know, he can run Europe. Yeah. So while we traveled around to Europe, when I worked for Iacocca, with Mr. Ford's bailiwick. Going back to the other two segments, though, as I say, the management of South American companies was different. The environment was different. The just the whole atmosphere was different. The people were obviously different and not very well understood by many people in the company here. And so long as they were doing all right and not making a lot of waves or causing problems, they pretty much let the vice president in charge of Latin America, which was Molina,
mm-hmm.
And the vice president of Southeast Asia, which became to be Bill Burke, by the way.
Yes.
At one time, Burke worked for Molina. When Burke went to South America, or Southeast Asia, it was assigned to Molina. So Molina was vice president, the longest title in the company. Vice President, South American, Ford Automotive, and Southeast Asia.
Right, yeah.
We had a funny name for it, but it covered everything. And Australia, of course, was
yes.
the big operation there. And as I mentioned the other day, they eventually separated those two, Southeast Asia, and left Ed with South America. But as I say, nobody understood those areas very well, and they let them run the biggest problem they ever had. Kind of interesting. You may recall that we had in Argentina, we had some shootings. There were, matter of fact, I guess there were a total of two, maybe three people killed.
Yeah.
And the decision of what to do about the people over there, particularly the Americans over there.
Right.
And that became a crisis of some proportion that was, I know there were around the clock meetings literally all night trying to determine how dangerous it was, how bad it was, what, should we abandon it, just walk away from it? You can't walk away from $1 million installation. You got people relying on you and so forth. And the decision was, should we pull all the Americans out? Historically, we like to have in those foreign locations, even in Europe, although we're getting away from it now in Europe, Yankee, as we say, as managing director, and a Yankee as a finance manager.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the people could be, and were encouraged to be natives, mm-hmm. as it were, locals. But those, in Argentina, it was such an issue that they, what they did, they told the managers, telexed them, be prepared to leave in 24 hours,
mm-hmm.
and they. Pulled them out to Paraguay, I guess, or Uruguay, someplace like that.
Yeah.
And left that management down there in charge of the Argentinians,
mm-hmm.
promoted whoever was the highest ranking guy to managing director. And guess what? They did great.
Really?
They did. They yeah. were very, very, now, you know, they were very profitable, but that wasn't necessarily yeah. because they were Argentinians. Profit in the automobile business, it was the United States or Uruguay or Mexico or England. Is a function of so many
mm-hmm.
different factors that to ascribe profitability or the other side of that coin, tremendous losses to any one factor is obviously misleading or naive because it doesn't work that way. There's a lot of factors that come together.
Right.
So in substance, the European or the international piece of the arm was never in people's mind as important as U.S., although in some tough times in the U.S., it was Europe that particularly, yeah, it was Europe more than South America, that made the company look halfway respectable in their performance, profitable profit and loss statement and
right.
so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I enjoyed the year and a half or so I worked with Ed. I finally...
this is Molina's?
Ed Molina, yeah.
Molina.
Molina. And finally, I thought I'd learned all I was going to learn, although that was quite a bit. And I finally, I don't know exactly how I did let the word get out that I was ready for a transfer, and that's... Mr. Ford called me in one day and said, I understand you've had about all of Molina you can stand. Works that
typical
the way you
approach
it. And I said, well, I learned quite a bit and I enjoyed it and so forth. And he said, we're going to have we're going to reorganize the committee system again for the umpteenth time. And we're going to have a policy committee and I'd like to have you come run that as a secretary of the policy committee. I said, you'll work for me, you'll take your direction from me. And he said, I will assign you organizationally the only guy he had reporting to him really was Jim Cummings, you know.
Right, yeah, of course. Of course.
He said, I'll assign you over on Fred Secret's staff. Fred was a vice president, or executive vice president of administration or something like that.
Right, yeah.
And he said, you'll be over there for rations and quarters, but he said, your work will be with me on the assignments on the policy committee.
That's about 1972, 73.
Well, I guess that's about however it figures out in there. Whatever.
Yeah, 73.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
well, this is a pretty big assignment, at least in
outline. It's kind of funny. You say somebody is the secretary of a committee, you know, in a corporation.
Yeah.
Well, at first glance, a person may think, well, that's a clerical job, you know. What do? They put out the agenda and they take notes and they write minutes and they keep the records and you know, that's a really a high paid clerk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In the company on these committees in Ford, it actually was a fairly important job because you as the secretary really had a lot to say about what items should come to the committee in the first place.
You set the agenda, really.
And so we set the agenda and to keep track of what should come to the committees and most importantly when.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great tendency
priority
in the company for the line management not to want to come to the committees, you know. Let me do it myself. I don't need a bunch of staff guys to help me. I don't need Henry looking over my shoulder. Just let me do it, and we'll get around there eventually. What they really were saying, after everything's done, well, then we'll come and tell you about it.
Right, yeah.
And Mr. Ford, as I say, was thought he was being sold anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, you're right.
He's looking for more input.
Yeah. Yeah,
right, yeah.
And really, and because I'd been around quite a while, and he'd gotten to know who I was through my in the product planning staff work and so forth, and he counted on me to really advise him not only, you know, what the hell we should bring to the committee and when, but he also sort of said, what's going on? It was kind of a, what's going on? What are these guys trying to sell? Why are we, you know, before we ought to take a look at the FIERA program. Okay, what's up with the FIERA program? Well, there's some problems and there's some difference of opinion, I understand. You know, you had to be careful. You didn't want to be the guy that was running to the boss and whispering in his ear, but on the other hand, he was asking you to fill him in on what the issues were, and the issues invariably involve people.
Right.
So it was in that role that then this policy committee was supposed to be sort of a super committee, and I guess it pretty much stayed that way. As a
nothing higher in the committee structure.
There wasn't at that time, and technically the executive committee was higher, but it acted. It rarely met, and it met only in sort of emergency sessions when the board couldn't be assembled. So the policy committee was sort of the central location in that.
Central planning.
It was really central planning, and it was not, it was went beyond product too.
Yeah.
It went into a number of other things, facilities, and it did not deal with personnel. Usually they had the personnel committee, which made up of outside directors and so forth for that, for obvious reasons.
Compensation.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, in that period of time when I was in there, I got to know Mr. Ford on a working basis quite well, and he was, he always had, his door was open. I had no problem of getting a direction to see him, you know. There were a couple times, Fiesta happened to be one.
You meant the Fiesta a moment ago, didn't you?
Yeah.
You said Fiero.
I meant the Fiesta, when the issue was naming the car.
Oh,
the car
going
to be named.
The code name was Bobcat, wasn't it?
That's right. And there was a lot of, you know, they did research like they always do. And naming, naming cars was always a big
headache.
A big headache, yeah. And I remember one time when that issue was coming up, and we'd been through the research and people had various ideas and favorites. Mm-hmm. Mr. Ford told me in the office one day, he says, I know what we're going to call it. But he said, I'm not going to tell anybody. And it was Fiesta. He decided on Fiesta.
You'd sort of gotten out of basic product planning at this point. You were into policy.
Yeah. Although you got to remember that
it's all product.
But the bulk of management's time was then, and I think perhaps, well, I guess it still is, was product. The decisions on the theory, or at least the operating position that most of these people took, was if the product's right, if the product's competitive, and that includes right by being cost effective, mm-hmm. everything else will sort of take care of themselves and to a certain degree in the business. That's true now. I say I think it still takes up the bulk of their time, but when we started to get help from the government regulators, Mr. Nader, and egged on by Mr. Nader and the various safety and transportation authority and so forth, then more and more of management's time got absorbed with government. But frequently a good part of that was product, you know, the emissions, the fuel economy, the safety issues. 99% of them were related to the product. There were some that were related to the plants, you know, you couldn't emit carbon monoxide out of a plant and the paint system and so forth.
Right.
Basically, it was product. Mm-hmm. So, while the charter, you might say, of the policy committee was larger than just product, a good percentage of the time was still product.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it'd be interesting at this point to digress a bit and to tell us your observation of your working relationship with Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford has been analyzed to the nth degree in recent years, but I don't think anyone has ever said much about a relationship which was largely professional. You found him obviously much more of a corporate person than he's been made out to be in recent accounts.
Yes. Thoughts on that. Mr. Ford, in my opinion, was a tremendous guy. Put it in the vernacular, was a tremendous guy. Mm-hmm. If for no other reason than the fact that he worked at the job.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given the background, the history of the family and so forth, Mr. Ford could have elected at an early age to go off and live on the Riviera or wherever he wanted to, and
to cop out,
yeah. And could have, he couldn't have spent all the money that he had if he'd lived to be 1,000.
Yeah.
He did not do that, obviously, and I believe, I feel very sure of this personally, that it was a matter of great pride, Mr. Ford. He felt the responsibility to continue the heritage of the company, and much has been made about his saying, "My name is on the building," and he used that phrase time to time in meetings, but he didn't use it lightly. He took it seriously, and he worked at it. So that was number one. Number two, Mr. Ford had in an odd sort of way, something that's rather rare in top corporate executives, I believe, and that is a fairly heavy dose of humility. Mr. Ford did not pretend to know all of the answers. He, and so many top executives feel that they have to carry an image of almost infallibility about. Wasn't Mr. Ford's case at all. Mr. Ford was very, in that sense, humble. and say, I don't understand. Let's go over this again, and what are you getting at, and so forth. And this was true in many areas, but most true, or at least it seemed to come out more, in the area of great importance, styling, the appearance of the cars.
Right.
He would say many times, I think I described the other day how you go from models and you got various alternatives and you get down to the short strokes and you got to pick one and go with it. And in those, and he was always very active in that, right in the middle of it, as was all the other top officers of the company. Mr. Ford would frequently say, you fellas all seem to like, say, Model B. I don't. I like A. Mm-hmm. But you have to build them and you have to sell them, mm-hmm. not me. So he said, I'll go with you on that. And that, you know, it was a, I can't recall any other executive, including Mr. Iacocca, that ever evidenced that sort of a humility, as it were.
Right.
There was an area where he was rather adamant, and that was one I mentioned before, was names. He wanted to, unless he agreed with the name, by George, it wasn't gonna go by. And he made an issue of that.
I wonder if this harks back to the fiasco they had with the naming of the Edsel.
I don't really know.
He was out of town when that was done, and published reports a breach pushed it through.
I know he wasn't in the meeting when the decision was made. He withdrew from the meeting, but. There was another thing that Mr. Ford felt strongly about, but again, he recognized the responsibilities that he had placed on his line operators. Mr. Ford felt or believed for a long time that our product line, as well as the competition, was much too complicated. We had too many models, too many series, too many of everything, and it was that we would be better off if we would not have Fords, Falcons, Mustangs, Thunderbirds, Edsels, Mercurys, Lincolns, Marks, you know, on and on and on and on. And he would, this was a continuing concern of his, and he would bring it up rather regularly, and of course the people that that were wanted to keep the cars were in the sales operation, and they'd say, Mr. Ford, if you drop whichever one you drop, you're going to lose penetration points. You know, we were at that time, we were hitting about 25% of the market.
Yeah.
And if you're going to drop this one, you're going to lose two. Well, we may or may not have. He did feel strongly in those areas. He, as I say, he... did his homework. He was active when he was running the meeting. He ran the damn thing. You know, he wasn't just sitting there having somebody else run. He was stamping like that. He to a certain degree, Mr. Ford felt that he got more information on an issue if there was a pretty good disagreement among the people. And some people have characterized this as Mr. Ford liked to see people argue a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can put it that way. But he did enjoy a good heated debate, let's put it, among various aspirants to causes.
Mm-hmm.
And he encouraged it. Now, you know, those are all good things, any of us, did have a few flaws here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Was sort of, if you got on his bad list, it was very difficult to get off, if you ever got off.
Yeah.
He got some people that on his bad list for again, various and sundry reasons. The most outstanding one was Hal Sperling, when Hal was the chief product planner at Point M, brilliant man.
What could you tell us about that episode? It's always been a fascinating one, I think.
Well,
you'll probably get to it in the course of the 70s, but was it the downsizing pretty much?
It was pretty much, I'll have to recall which one was Sperling's problem. Downsizing was one issue, but I guess I can't recall the specific product issue, and there probably wasn't a single one. Yeah, really what it was is he thought Sperling was selling him.
I see.
Well, yeah. Going back to this thing of you won't listen, you keep pounding in where you should. Well, I know one part of it was the bringing over of the car before the Escort. What am I trying to think of? What was the Fiesta? Yeah, the Fiesta.
Right. Bringing it over this country.
We, to this country, building it here.
Mm-hmm.
Iacocca thought it ought to be built here, and Sperling did too, and Mr. Ford didn't.
Yeah.
Mr. Ford publicly admitted that he was wrong. I've read this in published statements where he said, I was wrong. I didn't think the American public wanted a car that little, or expressway and so forth. Mm-hmm. He said, I was wrong.
Yeah.
Well, he may have been wrong, but by that time, Sperling was hitting the bricks, as it were. And
put him on the shelf, didn't they, for a few months?
Well, yeah, he fired him, and he gave him an office to send out his resume. And of course, he landed on his feet over at Chrysler, and
proved to be a great ally of Iacocca's.
Well, Iacocca and Sperling were. Sperling was probably closer to Iacocca in the company than any other single executive that I know of, but he was.
That was part of the problem with Mr. Ford too.
Oddly enough, executives, even the top placed ones, have jealousies.
Oh yes.
And
well, especially I think at that level, he felt himself somewhat isolated. Did he not? From what you said.
Sure.
And he wanted more input.
Sure.
And when he felt somebody was going around him to.
Course.
He would set up a little empire.
That's the way Iacocca sort of took care of Bunky. He isolated him and said, you're the boss's guy, you run it. And Bunky said, yeah, where are my help? And well, you're a helper over here helping me. That's oversimplification.
I was about to ask you just about that. I thought at this point it might be a good idea to ask you about your observations of the Knudsen presidency, how it came about, and what happened, and how he was finally isolated.
Well, it came about as a rather complete surprise to all of the people in the management of the company, because I happen to remember that one quite well.
Mm-hmm.
If I may not remember the year correctly, I guess it was 68. That he came in
late '68.
Well, no, when he came, when he was announced, whatever year it was, maybe it was early '69. We had been, my wife and I and another guy, been planning a vacation down in the Bahamas, and we had a product planning meeting coming up, we'd scheduled the thing in such a fashion that. After the product planning meeting was over, I was secretary of product planning committee, then we'd go to the Bahamas. Well, the date came for going to the Bahamas, and Mr. Ford, on about three or four successive days, called me up and said, defer the product planning committee meeting. Defer the product planning committee meeting. So I deferred it. And then finally he called me up, and I remember it was my birthday. He said, have it, we'll have it on February 7th. And
February 6th.
Yeah, and so.
I'm 68.
Yeah, so I said, okay.
Right.
So we called the meeting, and everybody was there, around the board table in the boardroom, except Mr. Ford. And when everybody was seated and so forth, why, the doors open and Mr. Ford rings Mr. Knudsen in and says, "Here is the new president of the Ford Motor Company."
Seaman Knudsen.
Whoa.
Wow, what a bombshell.
And he'd done it all himself. You know, yeah. He had done it all himself.
I understood he went out in an Oldsmobile to talk to Knudsen in Bloomfield Hills. So he would be very nice.
Wouldn't surprise me. But he did it, and he had some advice from some of his relatives that said, "That isn't very smart, Henry. You got to buy Coga there." And Mr. Ford reportedly took the position. Mr. Icoga's a lot younger than Bunky, and he'll have his turn and so forth.
Sure.
And I've selected Bunky, and that's it. And away we go. Well, we didn't go away very fast, as you well know. Mr. Knudsen, sort of one of the problems of believing his own advertising, you know, it always is a problem if you do that. He wasn't as good as his advertising said he was, and he didn't see that. And he tried, I'll show these guys, these dummies at Ford, how we do it at GM. You know, we get things done. Me and John DeLorean, you know, we know how to do things. And he was ramrodding around. He brought in about a half a dozen people. Larry Shinoda, the designer, he brought him in. He brought a guy by the name of Johnson in, who was sort of a marketing guy, and I think he was over in Lincoln Mercury Division or something like that. And then,
excuse me, I think we're just right at the end of the tape.
Called by the name of Johnson, and I don't know exactly where he ended up. And then there was another fellow whose name I should be able to recall that came into design too, but he was not a designer in the sense of a what we call a stylist.
Was that Dave Wheeler?
Dave Wheeler, yeah. Dave was the guy. And Shinoda, Bordenay was the vice president of design then. And Mr. Knudsen and Mr. Shinoda seemed to, on several occasions, operate as though they were the only two people in the design center, and there wasn't any intermediate management in between. And you can imagine how Mr. Bordenay reacted to that.
Yes.
And Shinoda reportedly, all kinds of reports, he was going to be the first Oriental designer vice president in the country, in the company. And later on, when Bunky was fired, Bordenay was in Europe, and they called him and told him what happened. And they said, "Do you want us to let Wheeler and Shinoda go?" And he says, "Nah, he says, keep them there." He says, "Wheeler, we may keep." He says, "I want to personally fire that son of a bitch, Shinoda." And he did, boy. He went and he got back and he brought him in and he fired him.
Mm.
But Bunky used to work with Shinoda, and this is not just hearsay. Bunky was a great performance guy, and they had a Talladega. Talladega at that time was one of the big performance racetracks, you know.
Right.
And
Georgia.
Alabama.
Alabama.
Yeah, Alabama. And Knudsen set up the Knudsen Trophy for the Talladega some run or something, and he had Larry design it for the design center. And I remember one time we were all standing around from a design meeting, you know, and was over, and Larry was there, and Knudsen said to him, "Larry, how's the design on the trophy coming?" "Well, I happen to have it here, Bunky." I take a look, so he shows it to him, and Bunky says, "Yeah, that's pretty good, Larry. I got some ideas. Why don't you and your wife come over Sunday afternoon and have cocktails at the house, and we'll talk some about the Bordenay standing." I'm just trying to point out the relationship.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Very awkward for all around.
Very awkward for all around. I, because of the fact that I had at that time, the Central Product Planning Office.
Right.
I sort of felt sorry for Mr. Knudsen, to tell you the truth. He wasn't. as competent as he thought he was. He certainly didn't live up to his reputation, which we didn't see evidence of it. And he didn't have a chance, you know. Christ, I Koga had people locked in tighter than hell, and Stryker wasn't the most subtle guy. Isn't the most subtle guy in the world, you know. He let you know he was he was seeing how you were bouncing that ball.
Mm-hmm.
So there was Knudsen standing there. Dave Wheeler, as far as I know, is still with the company.
He just retired.
Did he?
Yeah, about 3 months ago.
No. Dave, I like Dave. He was his expertise, at least initially, and I don't know whether was in aerodynamics. He did a lot of the work of how you get the cars to be, as we
right.
say, slippery.
Right, worked with the wind
tunnel. Yeah. One little joke, funny that at the time when Bunky was fired, the design center had a little dining room. I may have mentioned this the other day. Off the engineering dining room. It was for design center executives, styling executives. And because I was there, I reported to Bill Ford, as did Bourdonnais.
Mm-hmm.
And so I ranked enough, I could have dinner in there or a lunch in there. And a couple of my guys, one of the fellows' name was Al Charlette, who subsequently retired. Was also, he was my number two guy, so he was eligible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the day they fired Bunky, we all went to lunch, that was a big topic of conversation.
Had it happened in the morning?
Did it happen in the morning, yes, I worked. Wheeler came in, day rated there, and there was just a very quiet,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And Dave sat there, he says, well, he says, I guess maybe I'll not be having lunch here much longer. And this was, I think, a little bit before, well, I don't know what month it was, but before Christmas sometime.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Charlette got off really the thing that broke the ice. And said, he says, "Oh, Dave," he said, "they, you probably will stay on. They're not going to fire you. But just in case they do, Merry Christmas." Broke everybody up, you know. Even Dave laughed. But Mr. Knudsen just couldn't do anything, and obviously wasn't getting the kind of cooperation he needed.
Yeah.
He didn't understand the Ford system, which easy to see why he didn't. But he did, I think, he might have made his lot a little easier, or might have even survived, although I doubt it.
Yeah.
If he had a little more, I don't know it all, fellas, but
yeah.
There was a tendency of, I've been here before and I know it. And it was humiliating. I remember after he was fired, his son or son-in-law or somebody was moving in the area. And they needed a van of some kind.
Yeah.
And Bunky called me up at the office and said, we were on a first, I was on a first name basis. Chalmers, I was referring to Mr. Knudsen.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Chalmers, can you get a van for me, like my son-in-law?" He said, "Sure." And so we got it and so forth.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I got to have a fairly good, as good as you could have a working relationship with the Monkey is a fellow who had been my secretary went over and became his secretary. A fellow named Harold Steffen.
S-T-E-P-H-E-N.
Mm-hmm. Last I heard of Harold, and I don't think he'd be retired yet because he was younger, he was in the credit company someplace. But in any event, because Harold had worked for me for quite a while and then
right.
kept in touch.
Yeah.
So much for
nice enough guy, but just didn't live up to his promise.
Yeah, he was he should have swallowed his pride early on and stayed with GM, and probably would have.
Waited out Ed Coe. As it turns out, Ed Coe was killed 3 years later.
Yeah, that's right.
And he might have been
Mr. Ford, when he saw it wasn't working, he fired him and. The famous quotes just didn't work out, or
yeah.
words to that effect.
Yeah, right. He's used that to good effect.
Interesting question as to who gave Bunky the word, though.
Have you ever found out?
I've got a guess.
Okay.
But I'll make an educated guess.
Okay.
That it was Bill Ford.
You may well be right. Yeah. Bill was usually the go-between in delicate matters like that.
That's right. Yeah.
Because of the more, a little more sensitivity, perhaps.
Well, yeah, and Bill was... Bill was pretty much, I think you can say this, universally liked.
Yeah, right.
I worked for him on two different sets of periods of time, and I liked Bill, still do, for that matter.
Yeah.
And he just, it'd be difficult to be not like Bill, you know.
Right.
Very quiet. He's his own man, you know,
right.
And a lot of people critical of Bill have been over the years because of his little participation in the company. He didn't participate, and I used to talk to him, you know. Every once in a while, something would come up, and he said, "Oh, hell." But his rationale was, he said, "This company has enough damn trouble with one Ford, Henry. Says, Christ, if there were two of us." And he said, "We decided to go different ways, he'd tear the company up."
Basically, I think that's the way he operated. He didn't want any divisions in the company.
That's right.
Henry was strong-willed enough to be able to pretty much get his own.
Yeah. And, while most of the stuff I've said here has been very positive about Mr. Henry Ford, he was, you know, on balance, I think he was very positive.
Right, uh-huh.
Some of the negative things were pretty bad, in my view,
mm-hmm.
and I think in other views, including his relatives.
Mm-hmm.
It was
autocratic and often capricious.
Yeah. And, well, I guess the company is fortunate, I have to put it this way, that so far, and I guess maybe now that Mr. Ford's out of it, it isn't all that big an issue, that there was never a public blow up.
Right. Yeah.
And boy, we came so close so many times. Now, the Benson Ford thing, incidentally, Molina was involved in that.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Still with the company?
Yeah, he was still with the company, and this was when Benson, the idea was that they were going to send Benson down to Mexico.
Oh, yes.
And he was going to do work in the Mexican company like Edsel did in the Australian company.
Right.
And matter of fact, the first time I heard about that deal was when Benson Jr. and his advisor, the guy that conned him out of all his dough.
Yeah.
He had two guys. I can't think of their Fustus or Faustus, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They flew down to Mexico for Benson to be interviewed, and I think Mr. Ford talked to
Fuentes.
Fuentes, that's the guy.
Fuentes.
Yeah, and then there was another guy.
Two of them.
A little short, chubby guy. I knew he flew to Europe with us one time on the 727. Was also in with Benson. And they flew down to Mexico with him. And Ed Molina suspected that there was something that didn't quite smell right in that whole deal. And when they wanted him to come to work for Mexico, he said, well, what he told me was that I couldn't refuse, you know.
Sure.
But he says, I sure as hell didn't look forward to it. Well, it never worked out. So much for that.
You continue with the policy committee, but you also now have, in 1977, you've been assigned to the office of the president. How'd that come about?
Well,
that
was Lee. As a matter of fact, I think when I got that, I think I got off the policy committee.
Did you? Uh-huh.
I think that the policy committee went to, I guess we still had it, but it went to somebody else, Charlie, Gross Point Charlie, I can't think of his name. In any event, Lee had a small staff. He had about four or five of us, I guess. A fellow named Tom Denemy.
How do you spell that?
D-E-N-E-M-Y.
Yeah.
Tom, for a long time, was, and I'll take that back. Tom was not, I guess he was on ICORCA's staff. Connors, the sales marketing guy. Mm-hmm. Was it Bill Connors? There are two Bill Connors in the company, so you got to be careful which one you're talking. Mm-hmm. Art Connors. This was Art Connors.
Okay.
Art Connors was on it. I was on it. Who else do we have? Later on, Matt McLaughlin was on it, I think.
Yeah.
But in any event, it was a group of about three or four, and the job there was to be Lee's. Well, I always described it as Lee was the kind of guy that needed somebody to go along behind him and pick up pieces and interpret for him. As I think I mentioned the other day, Lee was a quick study, made quick judgments. Some people thought he made them too quick, and perhaps he did in some cases. But he really did need somebody to interpret for him and to, it's one thing to say, well, we're going to go do this now. Okay, meeting's over. Well, when are we going to do it? Who's going to do it? Well, how are you going to start it? Who's going to be in charge? That kind of
thing. The nuts and bolts.
Yeah. I was the guy that sort of had that job for me. I was sitting on his meetings, and he set up what was called an operating committee.
Had not had one before?
They've had every committee in the company known to man.
It's called an operations committee.
Operations. Maybe it was an operations committee.
Yeah.
But in any event, it was Lee's committee. And he had a bunch of subcommittees come out of that. And some of those still even survive the McKinsey onslaught, but this is what he had when McKinsey came in, and a lot of that got changed around. But in any event, Lee would have his meetings, and I would be there. And instead of minutes, I did minutes, but they weren't me. I was the guy that made up the assignments that came out of the thing, and. That was probably the period of all the damn near 30 years I spent with the company that I felt I was, one, contributing really the most, and two, I was probably being more helpful to others than I had ever had an opportunity to be before, because people wanted to do what Lee, Lee's a strong leader, and he had a loyal following. People, they weren't naive. They knew that Lee wasn't going to lay down in front of the tracks for them.
Right.
If it came to that. But Lee had their respect. He was smart, and he was energetic.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to do it, but what in the hell did he mean? What did he want? And invariably, the way we'd operate, or not invariably, but frequently, after a meeting, I would go off and I'd take my rough notes and I'd sit down and I'd say, okay, there are four things that he gave direction on. This, this, and this. This ought to be done by finance. This ought to be done by Ford Division sales. This ought to be done by product development, or this ought to be done by engineering. And I'd list down concept, general direction, specifics, including check dates, 30 days report back. And I'd fire these up to Lee and say, this is how I interpreted it. What, didn't I miss something? Mm-hmm. And 99% of the time he'd say, okay, send it back. Matter of fact, I got so I would send a buck slip, make up a buck slip for him to sign with, over his signature, which say, Harold McDonald, attached to the agreements we reached, meeting as I've noted, LAI. Mm-hmm. I got a file of notes from LAI. I got, I'm just about ready to dump those things.
Don't. Bring them over here.
Well, there are some in there that are not many, though. But there are tons of blue letters in there, organization charts. I got, and policy. I got
policy minutes?
Policy letters. Policy letters. You guys want that stuff?
Of course, yes, we do. Yeah,
well, maybe. Well, I haven't thrown any away yet, but I'm just about to. There must be a. I'll bet you that if I took all the books I've got dealing with that, that I could fill a box almost as big as your desk.
Right.
I think.
That's good. We'll come over and help you pack and bring it.
Well, let me look through them, and I'll probably take you up on that.
Fine, yes.
I will have to do a little waiting. There are some things in there that I kept a diary for a long time, and in the period of time after Lee left, and I worked for Bill Ford, I got a tremendous insight into relationships within the family, particularly between Bill and Henry.
Right.
And how he felt about things, and how Henry, and where he and Henry differed, and some of the very difficult times they had.
Mm-hmm.
They really
yes.
had. Mr. Ford was a very concerned person. I guess we all are,
sure.
As far as our families are and go. But Henry Ford.
Uh-huh.
And the last thing in the world he wanted to do was to alienate Bill.
Right.
And he sort of felt, from most of this is what Bill told me, he sort of felt that he didn't have to explain his actions to anybody or justify them to anybody except Bill.
Right.
He sort of seemed like he went out of his way to try to have Bill understand, even the ousting of Ford, you know, when he went around to the directors and met him in New York and all this stuff.
I think you're right. I think he respected Bill's opinion, and he felt he was the last male person in the family that he, Benson was gone, and Benson had always been something of a different person, of course.
Yes, Mr. Benson Ford was a loyal family member, very, very quiet. If you ever had, he was always a member of the product planning committee and the design committee, but very, very rarely said anything. He literally said anything.
He, that's true.
He would come to the meetings and he would listen, and occasionally Henry Ford would, Ben, what do you think about that? And Ben, all right, But he was never, he too probably recognized one Ford was enough for the company.
Yeah,
I always liked Mr. Benson. Oh,
yeah.
I like him all, but
nice
Benson Ford, just a real nice guy. And I got to know him on a High Chalmers basis.
Yeah,
Mr. Ford.
Yeah.
Remember, I was looking through my stock portfolio the other day, he sold me. He didn't sell them to me, but he told me about some, this was way back, Henry Ford Hospital, whom he was president, I guess, at the time, or chairman of the hospital. You know, somebody had the museum here, one of the Fords had the museum, one had the hospital,
that's right.
This and that.
Yeah.
That the Henry Ford Hospital was issuing some bonds for expansion. At that time, they were paying a pretty good rate for, this was way back, 7% or something like that. And they were tax exempt. First time they had a hospital have been able to get a tax exempt, rather common now, but they so I still got the damn thing. I think they run till 1990. Before I forget it, my wife wanted me to ask over here, and I'll ask you. There is a gift shop in the museum. Is there any...
Mr. Chalmers, could you give us a, perhaps a, the reason why you were assigned to the Office of the President in 77? What, do you remember what, how it came about?
Well, I believe Lee asked for me.
Uh-huh.
I think. Mm-hmm. Now, I wouldn't want to swear to that.
Yeah.
In the policy committee, I was working, of course, for Mr. Ford, and that may have been one of the reasons Lee asked for me, if he did.
Was Lee a member of the policy committee, by the way?
Yeah, he was a member of the policy committee, but it made a difference who was Mr. Ford was dealing with on setting agendas and deciding issues and so forth. Oh, yes, he was a member, as were the top division managers and so forth.
I mean, he had a regular attendance.
Yeah, and that was another thing about Mr. Ford. By gosh, Mr. Ford went to meetings. It was rare, and God knows we had a lot of meetings. Oh, man. At one time, I kept score for a while of, say, for a month. The meetings that I went to, which weren't all of them, because there were meetings of the Finance Committee and some of the others that I was involved in, and just who was there.
Yeah.
You know, you'd fill up the boardroom, and the meetings would go on for hours. And the question was, who is running the store?
Mm-hmm.
You wonder how these guys could run the divisions and run the operations. And they all had responsible jobs. They'd sit in those damn meetings day in and day out. The company runs a lot, or felt it had to, by consensus, you know, in the sense that everybody had. The idea was that if you were at the meeting and a decision was made and it affected your operation, you better speak up or forever hold your peace.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't object, then by gosh, you were hooked.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's why we had big meetings.
Yeah.
It involved a lot. But the best I can remember, Lee asked for me.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'd worked, of course, with him with the Product Planning Committee.
Right.
Prior to the Policy Committee.
Yeah, right.
And when I was working for Iacocca, or for Molina, Lee would frequently call me in respect to something on product in the international thing.
Yeah.
I always, you know, Lee and Molina got along great. They were great buddies.
They would see things.
And Mr. Ford liked Molina.
Uh-huh.
There were about two or three guys, three that I can think of off the top of my head, excuse me, that maybe I mentioned this the other day, that Mr. Molina, or that Mr. Ford liked, one was Molina, and the other one was a guy that ran, ran Australia, recently retired.
Burke?
No, not Burke. Oh. Burke ran Asia Pacific.
Oh, that's right.
This was a Sir, God, he's a fixture of the company. He'd been around. The managing director of
Australia.
For Australia for years and years. I'll think of his name eventually. And the other one was Ferris, George Ferris, who was a vice president of the steel division for a while.
FARRIS.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'd have these meetings, quarterly review meetings. These guys would come in, you know, and present their plan and how they operated and so forth. And you can just tell which ones of those meetings Mr. Ford enjoyed and who he enjoyed in them, as opposed to those that he had to go to.
I said, speaking of good friends, I said Jack Davis died just recently.
Yeah, he did.
I
saw him in the paper. Yeah, that goes way back. That's the original.
Well, you in this job, you were involved with the action programs and involving you listed here advanced vehicle development, engineering, capital funding, and budgetary control. That's quite a portfolio there.
Well, you know, we were involved with them, and what it was developing alternatives, working with about a lot of this had to do with of going, you know, it was budget time, or budgets were coming up.
Right.
Lee would have some ideas, you know. For example, when I was working with Lee, and he would let me know generally what he was thinking about, mm-hmm. and I could, I would go out, talk to the divisions, and in effect, help them out a little bit.
Sure.
If they knew ahead of time what Lee was, you know, what he was primarily interested in, why it could save them some time and also help them figure out their strategy. Mm-hmm. But again, resumes tend to, and mine's no different, tend to make the person sound more important than he was. I have long had a cliche, and I really believe it. The Ford Motor Company, we had damn few executives, maybe one or two, but we had a lot of high-paid clerks.
Yeah.
And I was one of the high-paid clerks. I was not, never felt that I was an executive in the classic sense, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a relative thing, but.
You were in a unique position to make an assessment, I believe, of Mr. Iacocca's administrative abilities.
Yeah.
Would it be apropos for you to spend a few minutes on that subject?
Well, you
observed it.
Yeah. As you gather from what I said, Lee was a brilliant guy. He was particularly strong in areas of sales, where he made his original name, and in product. He had a feel for what people were wanting, what turned people on.
Right.
And he tended to be not very democratic in the process either. He, you know, he knew what he liked, and if he had the power, he put it through.
Yeah.
He was right more often than he was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. He people accuse him of being sort of a hip shooter, you know, and mm-hmm. sort of disorganized. I myself said he's the kind of guy that had to have somebody go around behind him and pick up things, which was true.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he had a feel for the need for a system, mm-hmm. even though he might not always operate that way. For example, one of the assignments that I got one time, and turned out to be a damn career assignment because it took so much time, was make me up a book of all a three-ring binder of all the things that I ought to have on my desk and be knowledgeable about and current about every day. And out of that, we went off and we got some nice plastic binders with zippers around them, you know. And I went through, you ought to know what the product program, where they stand, so you ought to have a product program section of three or four pages, and you ought to know where we stand on budget, you ought to know the capital
sure.
program.
Yeah.
You ought to stand on where the engineering budget are, the key things, what the sales penetration is, what the competitions are, what are the competitive product plans. That was the thing we tracked as closely as we could.
Right.
So I made a book, I mean, you know, about that type with tabs and,
sure.
well, making it up wasn't any problem, but keeping the damn thing up
right, yeah.
was the problem. Well, no sooner did anybody find out that Lee had one of those,
uh-huh.
than they had to have one of those. And I think we ended up